Good morning, and welcome to a brand new episode of Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute, the show that, when it starts 20 minutes on late, is starting just on time. Like wizards, we arrive exactly when we intend to, neither late nor early. So today we will be talking about Lake Town, and what is going on back there during the whole giant golden statue Smaug crazy chase scene that we bashed several weeks ago. So anyway, let's get started. Without any further ado, I am your co-host Dave Kale. With me as always are the Tolkien Professor Corey Olson and Trish Lambert. And let's get on to Meanwhile, Back in Lake Town.
But I want to say, if we get to be wizards, I think the rule should be that we only get to pick colors that are in the big Crayola crayon box.
Yeah, that's okay, true.
So they have to be those crayon names.
Can it be the names. Like the old school crayon? Like, you know,
yes,
can we have
absolutely.
like the Burt Umber wizards?
Yes, you know, absolutely.
Really? I was going to say it.
Oh, sorry, it's burnt sienna. It was raw sienna. Umber. I'm sorry. My apologies.
Yeah. Oh, Gerald,
pine forest green.
Definitely the 128 color box.
Yeah, exactly.
Cerulean.
as long as we don't have the flesh wizard. That one was embarrassing. But anyway,
Thimblebert the aquamarine. Anyway.
Did you like my old school Batman sound effect?
Yeah, that was an excellent touch. I like that. Yeah,
I think we'll go back and add in the real one.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I already found it on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, so today, before we begin our discussion proper, a couple quick announcements about. That impact the Riddles in the Dark world. The first is a change that we have had to make to our website. Several of you we know have been in the habit of commenting directly on blog posts that are made on the Mythgard website, especially those of you who are not on Facebook. Of course, the Riddles in the Dark Facebook page is the primary sort of discussion point for discussion site, rather, for people who, you know, want to add comments or explain in detail exactly how incorrect we were in our predictions and why. The Facebook Riddles in the Dark page is the best place to do such things. However, I know some people are not on Facebook or might have longer things to say than can conveniently fit into a Facebook comment. And so some people have been making comments directly, as I say, on our website. That is not going to be possible anymore. We had to shut down the comment feature. Yes, we've been under assault for a couple weeks now by agents of the Dark One, and we have had to put some new security measures in place on the Mythgard.org website. So one of the things that entailed was turning off our comments, so we don't have that anymore, which means if you would like to make a comment and you cannot use the Facebook page, we encourage you to send an email directly to our wonderful producer, Laura Burkholz, who will be collecting those bringing those together with me. So that's her email address is Burkholz, that's Berkholtz at Mythgard.org. So Burkholz at Mythgard.org. You can direct your comments and questions there, and she is going to be collecting them for...
Here's another one.
The new sub-series that we are doing. You may remember in years past we have done the Riddles in the Dark Digest, which has kind of grown and changed in different ways over the years, and it's back in a different form again this year, with a new and cooler name. That is, Laura Burkholz and I are co-hosting this new series, which I am calling Riddles in the Dark Super Erogatory, because Trish suggested Riddles in the Dark Extra, which I thought was good, but boring. So I think Super Erogatory is a much better word. And
it fits. I mean, he looked it up in the OED.
Oh, yeah, totally... Super Erogatory is a great word. It means doing more than is required of you. going above and beyond the call of duty. And it's especially fun because it is linked to a really theologically dodgy late medieval Catholic doctrine, you know, about like storing up excess grace by doing more good works than God required of you. Martin Luther would have had
six. So in that context, you and Laura are set.
Ah, man, it's going to be awesome. Yeah, so, yeah. So, yeah. So anyway, this is this is the new show. Well, it's sub show, Riddles in the Dark Super Erogatory, and we had our first episode on Monday morning. Laura and I did. Basically, what we're doing is, you know, we're going to go over generally a couple episodes at a time. We do the conundrum, and we talk about comments that we've gotten from listeners. Laura brings together, a selection of some of the best comments that we've gotten, and we discuss those individually. We're going to be doing a couple new features in that show. One of which is going to be, we're gonna have like the commenter of the month. What we would like to do is, you know, for when people submit really interesting comments, we would actually like to see if we could get that person to appear live with us, and discuss their comment, with us on the air, and then we also are going to be having a series of special guests join us on the show. Sometimes the special guests won't always be able to make it at the live recording time. Sometimes we might have to record our bit with the guest separately, but it will be included in the...
But so worth it.
Yeah, it will be included in the published thing.
Corey, will the bots that keep attacking the website be eligible to be commenters in the month?
Yeah, absolutely. I think yes.
If you can read Russian or Chinese,
right? Yes, we can have the exotic IP address of the month from which our robot attacks are coming. Yes, we can. yes, exactly. They would be very welcome. The attack robots, if they were to make cogent comments on the Hobbit film, would be very welcome to participate. I don't discriminate against somebody just because they are a robot and... trying to initiate a denial of service attack on our site. We're open-minded here. so that is, we just did the first one on Monday. The other fun thing about Riddles in the Dark Super Erogatory is that it will sort of come like a thief in the night. We will be doing those somewhat irregularly. So
for those of you who missed the old days of Riddles in the Dark when it would get sprung on you all of a sudden, no
exactly.
worries.
We now have this really staid and boring schedule, you know, this regular 2-week thing with pre-announced topics and links and everything. So in case some of you do need a little bit more spice back into your life, you know, there's going to be super erogatory to help you stave off the doldrums of your existence.
Never know when it will appear.
Exactly. So there you go. So that's those are the Riddles in the Dark announcements for this show. Excellent. Now let us move on to discuss the topic. So the thing I want to do first when we talk about Lake Town now, and our conversation of Lake Town here is rather circumscribed. This is we're not talking about everything in Lake Town or the whole Lake Town angle. In the Siege of the Lonely Mountain or anything like that. What we want to be talking about is the opening series in Lake Town. As Dave said, we ended film two with the dwarves and Bilbo at the mountain. You know, a fairly prolonged sequence there culminating in Smaug the Golden taking off and flying off towards Lake Town. the last we saw in Lake Town was Kiwi being saved from death, though I still don't know how mobile he is at this point. But anyway, he was preserved from death by Toriel, and Legolas, as we discussed last time, is going herring off towards Bolg and points south. Obviously, we're going to get the fight, but we've left Bard in prison. What will have been happening? How are things going to start off there in Lake Town? And to approach this, I would really like to go back a little bit and talk a little bit more, because this is something, you know, we did a whole episode last season about the politics of Lake Town, and we did, you know, in when we were thinking about Bard and how he was going to be depicted. And I think that it would be really helpful to go back and sort of think over what we did see in the Desolation of Smaug concerning Bard and the Master and his relationship there and the nature of the Master's regime, because just to sort of to make sure that we understand clearly what the situation is when it starts. That is, you know, we're going to be interested in talking about how is Bard going, you know, somehow Bard has to get from prison up to, you know, the ballista or windlass in order to shoot the dragon down. That seems relatively clear that that's going to happen. But to me, before we even get there, the bigger question is, why exactly is Bard in prison again? And I want to make sure that we understand that, because I think that that's not completely intuitive. So, anyhow, to me, the sort of focal point leading up to things, I mean, we have the general fact that the Master viewed Bard as a rabble-rouser, and he clearly is running running an oppressive regime. He holds himself above the rest of the people of Lake Town. The relationship between the Master and the people of Lake Town was a little odd to me, and a little bit hard to understand. It was almost as if they were trying to depict him as some kind of traditional, like some kind of hereditary aristocracy, like just someone who considers himself to be of such a different class from, you know, the run-of-the-mill people of Lake Town that he, that he despises them, while at the same time dominating them. But I had a hard time placing that. Kind of struggling with the nature of that. I mean, one thing that I found interesting about it is there are many interesting parallels to be made. That is the parallel between the Master of Lake Town and the people of Lake Town and Thranduil and the elves, for one. You know, that you have a little bit of a mirror image there, but a connection which was suggested to me by Rebecca Hunt at Mythmoot, was the parallel between the Master of Lake Town and the Goblin King, the Great Goblin in Goblin Town, and the way in which the two of them were both very parallel, sort of physically repulsive characters who nevertheless sort of did a lot of posturing of themselves. And Rebecca's point, which was a very interesting one, was that the main difference is that the Great Goblin was perfectly well aware that he was ruling over a menial pack of monsters and standing on a pile of garbage, whereas the Master of Lake Town seemed to actually give himself airs and seemed to sort of convince himself in some sense that he was, you know, grandiose in some way. He was, the Great Goblin seemed more sort of self-aware and self-parodic than the Master of Lake Town was. Anyway, what were your guys' thoughts about the Master of Lake Town, and in particular his relationship with Bard? How were you guys understanding that?
Hey,
we're waiting for the other one.
That was pretty. I do think one of my disappointments that film was that they didn't seem to give us too much more there. The Lake Town scenes went by really fast. I mean, they made it clear early on that there was that they were adversarial, and that they considered him a rabble rouser, but they didn't really give us enough about sort of why, and left us to kind of fill things in with, you know, especially those of us who are more familiar with the books and listen to the Tolkien Professor podcast, to fill in a whole bunch of stuff about, you know, oh, maybe it's because he's the heir of Girion and things like that. I did think, you know, probably the most interesting moment was when Bard is trying to dissuade the people from, you know, when Grimface Bard is the perpetual downer, is trying to persuade the people not to support Thorin and his attempt on the mountain. You know, he reminds them about the dragon, and I thought it was interesting that the master, you know, kind of says, "And who was it who screwed up and managed to not shoot the dragon with the windlass?"
Yes,
I thought that was interesting. Like, that was kind of a nice little moment, but we didn't get enough of that, so it's a little hard to speculate.
Yeah, I mean,
I think you have to really pay attention to. I think that's true. You know, I mean, I almost need to see the Lake Town scenes again at least two more times, because it's all of the. You know, I think the answer to your question is really embedded very cleverly, I suppose. I don't even know if that's the right word, in things like even the visuals, you know, the visuals of his house. And also, you have to really listen to what he says. You know, the thing about when Alfred says to him that they've been talking about elections, and he has that horrible shudder reaction to, oh my God, not elections. And the thing he just, like Dave was just saying, the thing he says to Bard, you know, what I want to infer, which I don't think we have evidence for this in the movie yet, is that he's afraid of Bard.
Yes.
Because Bard is Girion's heir, and, you know, he's worried that Bard's going to get support and oust him. But I think it's like you have to almost infer a lot of that, because it's, you have to listen to what he says and look at the trappings around him and his body language and what he does. I mean, it's very, I think they've concentrated a lot in there, but it's not overt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I agree, Dave, also that that comment about Girion missing was, I thought, the single most fascinating thing that the Master of Lake Town said, because there did seem to be a kind of defensiveness there. Even just the sort of the way the scene was presented when Bard came, when they had their showdown in the town square between him and Thorin with the Master there. The way that Bard stands forth out of the crowd, you know, emerges out of the crowd and stands forth and speaks authoritatively, that whole thing created this, you know, so if you remember physically how that scene was depicted, you had the Master standing up at the top of the steps, you had, yep, Thorin on the steps below him surrounded by guards, then you had the people around them, so you've got the Master standing up above the people, right? And then you had Bard emerging out of the people and coming up towards them and you know, and shouting and speaking authoritatively, not against the Master, against Thorin, right? And the Master then deciding as a consequence, almost, of Bard's opposition. You know, so we get those moments of you know, the Master kind of calculating in his head what is the best thing to do, you know, and then ending with welcoming Thorin and saying that he would support him. But clearly part of what is going on there for the Master is opposing Bard. If he goes along with Bard, I mean, he's siding with the people because Thorin has succeeded. You know, the film is clearly showing us that Thorin has succeeded in raising the hopes of the people, and that the people clearly want to side with Thorin and are less interested in the grim, you know, in the grim voice of Bard there, as he is opposing him. But again, it seems to be, because basically the position the Master is in there, if he sides with Bard, if he has Thorin thrown into prison here instead of supporting him, then he is merely backing Bard. You know, he's put himself in a really weak position. So he also has to kind of stand against him. Though again, there's no explicit Bard doesn't seem to actually have a faction. You know, though he's called a rabble-rouser, we don't see him actually raising any rabble or threatening
to. There seem to be no rabble following him.
No!
Well, and you know, the other thing with Bard is, I mean, Gerald Michael points out that, you know, he does have the people, you know, he has the people's welfare at heart, and he's really popular with the people, but I think the scene that you're talking about, in that particular part of the scene, the people prove to be very fickle. You know, he is the voice of reason in the sense of think of the dragon, think of what, you know, that could be happening if they go. And all Thorne has to say, we'll share the gold. And the people are like, yay! You know, there's not, and I think part of that probably is the social psychology of a oppressed people. You know, they see good times when Thorne talks about the gold. But Bard doesn't really have that much sway with the people that he can hold them in the face of that. You know, where I tend to think if he did have, you know, if he had more sway, if he did have more influence, there would at least be some people saying, well, maybe Bard's right, and nobody seems to be doing that. So it's an interesting thing, because he seems to not have as much support. Now, they're going to be fickle again
right.
when the dragon gets killed, you know, and then they're probably going to go, Bard is our hero, yay, we want him for king, you know. So I'm not really impressed with the fealty or loyalty of the people in Lake Town at this point.
Right. Right, and I mean, and that certainly the anticipation of the changing of the changeability of the crowd is certainly something
right.
that does seem to have been set up. I mean, I agree with Pete Reitzert here in general. He said that you know, the film depicts Bard as being something of an outsider from Lake Town society. You know, the townspeople back the master because they're small and mean spirited, or at least. Mm-hmm. As you say, small-minded and downtrodden. To me, right. the main way, you know, the main sense in which Bard is a rabble-rouser is not that he necessarily has a following, but because he's the only one who isn't sort of ground underfoot. You know, he's the only one. He's the only person in Lake Town who still retains a spine, essentially. And that seems to be what makes him dangerous to the master of Lake Town, that he's the only one who will defy him in any way. The only one who seems to... You know, but it's interesting, because it's not that he's the one who hopes to improve things or hopes to over... You know, he doesn't actually seem to have any plans to overthrow the master. He doesn't seem to, you know, one of the things we were debating last season was, are we going to get any flavor of King in Exile from Bard? You know, are we going to get any of this, like, I should be king, I have been deprived of my rights, you know, I should, like, lead a rebellion against the master. And I think, in the end, no, we didn't see that. You know, we didn't see him... And that's where I think that bit about Geryon missing seemed to play such an important role, mm-hmm. is because mm-hmm. he wasn't just, you know, a king in exile or you know, a king who's been, you know, the heir to the throne who's been deprived of his rule, but rather a disgraced monarch, you know, somebody who has lost his right to rule because they screwed up and have lost the will of the people. And that seemed to be exactly what the master of Lake Town was reminding him of, you know, that, like, the heirs of Geryon are not worthy to rule because the fall of Dale was their fault, you know, and so therefore we're not going to take them back.
You know, both Tom Hillman and Pete Reitzert point to something here. Tom compares, he says, wouldn't the people of Lake Town have the same attitude toward Bard as the brief folk had toward Shire? You know, at least...
Strider, right.
At least in the book, because we didn't see it developed all that much, I guess, in the movie. And then, you know, Pete says, and to follow on with that, Bard in general is an upstanding person, and people who stand for doing what's right no matter what are rarely popular. You know, those two kind of go hand in hand. And yeah, you know, you could kind of see that he's... You know, he's popular as long as there's benefit, you know, to him, and not popular if he's saying the wrong stuff.
Right, right. That most people don't want trouble.
Right, exactly.
And I mean, you can even see this, you know, from the, like, extensive spy network of the master. You know, you know, Colbert's crew, in, you know, on screen.
Yes, right. Led by Stephen Colbert.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that primarily impressed me about that, or rather the primary impression, I should say, that made on me was less the fact that, you know, the Master has this extensive intelligence service, and so therefore no conspiracy can really thrive against him, because he always knows everything that's going on, or at least Alfred, or whatever the name of his lackey was, does. Because, frankly, there didn't seem to be anybody to spy on except for Bard, and what it seemed to speak to more was the general complicity of the rest of the people of Laketown. You know, that most people in Laketown just don't care, and the rest of them do spy work for the Master. So, again, it just sort of exaggerates the extent to which Bard is alone in both being willing to stand against the Master and speak against the Master when necessary, and also his willingness to stand up and do the right thing.
Now, Brian does remind us. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to make a joke. I think the spy network is. I think the spy network is a part of the Master's putting Laketown back to work plan.
Right. Yes, it does increase the employment rate. You know, if you have an enormous number of people who are, yeah,
it's a way to deal with the quarterly labor report that comes out. Right.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Now Brian does point out, and I had kind of forgotten this, but Alfred, you know, does voice some concern to the Master over the possibility of a food riot breaking out at any minute. So, you know, that, again, see, this stuff is just packed within the dialogue, and you really have to listen to it, which, you know, leads me to think, well, the Master's influence really was more through the spy network and through fear rather than there being influence in the sense that we're talking about the Bard might have. So the hold is tenuous, and he's very, you know, he's paranoid, and probably rightfully so.
Yeah, and I would kind of go even further, and it seemed to me that you know, Alfred, is that right? Is that his name? Is that what he was called?
Yeah, Alfred. I think it's Alfred. Alfred, isn't it?
Yeah, the Alfred Wormtongue guy. He seems to be obviously the person who's actually ruling the city. You know, the first thing we see is him overtly manipulating the Master of Laketown into doing what he, Alfred, wants. I mean, all that stuff about elections and stuff, honestly, what reason do we have to think that the people of Laketown are threatening to hold elections and do an ouster on the Master? All we have is, you know, Alfred's word on that, which, you know, like, call me crazy, but he didn't strike me as extremely trustworthy. So,
as Brian has dubbed him, Lieutenant Unibrow.
Lieutenant Unibrow, yeah, there you go. Exactly. The guy always depicted in the promotional posters, you know, slinking behind corners and holding knives, you know. For some reason, he just rubbed me the wrong way. I don't know why, but
it does kind of make me wonder whether there's a pending betrayal.
Yeah.
Of the Master.
Yeah. Yes.
By Alfred.
Yeah.
You mean.
Yeah.
Could we end up with like a future scene where it turns out that it's that Alfred is the one who's running off with the money or something at the end?
You know, that I could really that I could easily see. You know, that it would be the Master that Alfred would use that knife on makes all kinds of sense. but yeah, I mean, he seems to be the one who is the actual power. Mostly, and I'm thinking here primarily of that first scene with the Master of Laketown, you know, the whole elections scene. What we see from him is that he's weak, he's clueless, and he's a drunk, and Alfred can, you know, maneuver him whatever direction he wants to go. So the question is, what is his ulterior motive? Now, are we going to get, do you think, that we're actually going to get some kind of Wormtongue angle? with him. That is to say, is he going to be merely an unscrupulous person trying to increase his own power by the manipulation of the Master of Lake Town, or are we going to have him revealed as some kind of evil agent in Lake Town?
Agent of Sauron?
Or something. You know, I mean, yeah.
Or Saruman.
Yeah, Saruman, yeah, exactly. Turns out Alfred was actually Grima's mentor, you know, and maybe we'll see like a adolescent worm tongue running off. I don't know, but I mean, seriously, do we think that that's going to be part of the bigger plot, or is this just going to be a pure internal Lake Town politics thing?
Oh, I bet it's just internal. These guys seem to be very narrow focused, not really caring much about the rest of the world. Or, I mean, the only way that could happen is if Sauron had actually dangled, or whoever had dangled, you know, riches in front of Alfred's face, and we haven't even had a whiff of that kind of thing yet. So I don't know.
Also, it's not clear why Sauron would be involved in it.
Yes, like, it's true.
Really, Sauron's gotten really bored.
right. That's the same.
Falling back on just messing around in local politics.
Right, I can really see this, you know, like there's a big council meeting between Sauron and the Ringwraiths, you know, after he springs them out of their tombs, you know, and he's like, task, how shall we take over Lake Town? We must manipulate Lake Town politics.
Yeah. Well, maybe he's really into fish, you know, maybe Lake Town's a fish source, he doesn't want to pay for fish anymore,
You know, what I can actually see at the council, he springs the ring raids, and they show up, and they're like, all right, boss, what's going on? What do we got happening? And he's like, I got big news for you. I have an agent planted at Lake Town.
That's right.
Close down the hookahs in the river. Forget looking for the ring. Go
That's
to
right.
Lake Town.
That's
yeah.
right. Yep.
The ring raids are really disappointed. They're like, oh, man. Really fallen far in during the centuries we've been locked up in the tombs. Pretty disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little difficult to imagine, as you say, Sauron taking a direct hand in Lake Town politics. And I don't think even thinking of just orc involvement, you know, independent orc involvement, seems very unlikely. I mean, Azog has been a free agent running around until this point. I wanted to bring that up because it's a question that a lot of people have asked me, you know, about the parallels between Alfred and Wormtongue and how far do we think they're going to take that? And it is just hard to see it, hard to imagine exactly how that would work.
I want to just give a shout out to our listeners today. I mean, we just can't go through all of them, but some people are making really funny comments. I mean, if you're hearing me giggle in the background, it's because I'm reading your comments. You're just a riot. You guys are really on point today. But one point somebody said, I think it was Luke, you know, the thing, this is a little bit of a side thing, but it's like, it is interesting, isn't it, that like the elves show up in Lake Town, nobody reacts. The orcs show up in Lake Town, and there's like nobody even in the the place was crowded like minutes before, and the orcs show up and have this enormous fight with an elf, and nobody, you don't even see people looking out their windows.
Right.
I thought that was really odd when I saw the movie. I thought surely he could have like not been quite so digital about it, you know, I mean, at least show the people like looking out windows or something from having been this crowded marketplace before.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, it's with the compression of the time frame as well, you know, one of the issues there is that if people are going to be roused by the fight with the goblins, then they'll already be roused when Smaug comes. Because those two things are presumably separated. But I don't know how much time. Well, actually, I mean, that's a good question, actually, and a good question which can direct us back towards the lead into Smaug in the early parts of film 3. How much time do we think has happened? How much time do you think we're supposed to understand has passed from Legolas riding over the bridge in pursuit of Bolg to Smaug flying from the mountain towards Lake Town? I mean, in film time.
Well, and if we go the other direction, which is when the elves leave, I mean, the dwarves leave Lake Town to the time Smaug flies away looks like it's about within a day, doesn't it? I mean, it's like...
Well, everything is within a day.
The Dale at noon, the sun, the moon comes up and opens the secret door that night, that same night, right? And then they have the fight with Smaug, and he goes off at maybe like 11 p.m. or so.
Right, it's still night. It's still that same night, yeah.
So it'd be like the next day after the dwarves leave that he gets to Lake Town, or in the early morning hours of that next day.
Right. And it's already dark when Bard is taken, right?
Is it? Yeah. because it's also dark, isn't it, when Legolas and Bolg...
Yeah, okay, so right. So if the Legolas-Bolg fight, Bard imprisonment thing, Bane, as he's called in the film, running off with the Black Arrow to hide it, or to keep it anyway... If all that's happening the same night, we are talking about a matter of hours. But, you know, I mean, in the Peter Jackson film, hours is, I mean, you can cross half a Mirkwood in that time, so...
Like, Erica says probably like 30 minutes. Or maybe Legolas is riding up at the same time Smaug is flying toward Lake Town, so he's not going to get very far before the dragon hits Lake Town.
But, hey, again, he could get halfway to Dol Guldur by that time. You know,
That's true.
Let's not overestimate this.
That is a really good point, though. Like, I have no sense of time for the last set of events. Because the Smaug chase scene is pretty freaking long. And it seems like it would eat up a lot of in-movie world time, but... Yeah, I have no clue. Like, and I'm kind of wondering. So, Trish, you asked a question in your email and in the Google Doc. Like, you know, how much on screen time will we get before the Smaug's attack begins? And I've been kind of wondering if they're going to roll it back a little bit. That they're going to give us a glimpse of events that were transpiring during what was going on in the mountain. So let's see. What did we witness already at the end of Desolation of Smaug? They felt like a tremor, an earthquake. We got a glimpse of Bard feeling an earthquake and then being like, "Guys, come on, guys."
Well, and Pete asks, "Did they not see a fire on the mountain?" I don't remember that in the movie. Did they see something from Lake Town?
I'm not remembering that either. There was the earthquake. But I don't remember them seeing fire.
They see light coming from the mountain, Brian says.
Do they? Okay.
And Kim says there was a glow, I believe. So, All right. I got to watch this again.
That would be, then, Smaug's emergence, because, of course, unlike in the book, there is no Smaug action on the outside of the mountain, which is what they see. You know, Smaug bashing and burning the side of the mountain, trying to catch the dwarves. You know, and that doesn't happen in the film, so all they can be seeing is Smaug's emergence there. So the clock is already ticking.
So unless Smaug travels substantially slower than the other denizens of Peter Jackson's Middle-earth, they have zero time.
Possibly.
He will emerge from the mountain and be at Lake Town in 5 seconds.
But...
Yeah, I mean, I was even wondering if we're going to get, like, a minute or two before the dragon.
So that's roughly... That's how long it took the dwarves to travel from Lake Town to the mountain in boats on foot.
Right.
Well, we do have the possibility we talked about Smaug falling asleep as he goes having the turret.
That's right.
He's gonna pull over to the side of the road on his way. Look, it's irresponsible to fly while I'm feeling sleepy. I'm gonna take a nap first.
take a nap, have my Silmarillion flashback dream, and then yes. That's true.
I would be willing. I'm leaning in the direction of there's not going to be very much time now. I was kind of thinking maybe we might roll things back, but I'd forgotten that we've actually gotten several scenes in Lake Town occurring during the whole Smaug chase scene. Maybe we're just going to start right with the arrival of the dragon.
At least in Lake Town piece.
Yeah.
Right, even if it doesn't start that way from the very beginning, yeah.
Well, I guess then to me the real question is, does the escape of Bard, you know, which obviously has to happen and is one of the early, you know, elements that has to be resolved at the beginning, does the escape of Bard or the, you know, the jailbreak, does that begin beforehand? You know, do we, or is that going to be something, I mean, do we really expect to see Lake Town like on fire around Bard while he's still in prison?
Well, we have seen him, we've seen the glimpses in previous, you know, production videos and whatnot of him running and sprinting through a burning Lake Town, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's a good question, and I'm wondering about that too, because given sort of the layout, the type of town that we've given, I don't see how Smog doesn't burn the whole thing in one pass. I mean, honestly, it's small.
It is like kindling too. I mean, it's like, you know,
it's small and dense and entirely built out of wood, dude. Like, that thing's gonna go up in a blaze in 5 seconds.
I think it's the attack that's gonna spur springing Bard from jail, because what's going to happen is the guards are going to desert their posts, people are all going to be panicked, and the need to get Bard out of jail is going to become, you know, like a real obvious thing. I think it'll be the early days of the attack.
The jail may just burn down around him. He just
<That's true. laughs>
doesn't even have to break him out.
Steam from the lake will interfere with Smaug's aim. Gerald. Well, actually, Dave, let's remember that the stupid dragon couldn't kill one single dwarf.
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, we're not going to be too surprised when he can't burn Lake Town with one.
I was just thinking that very thing. I was like, oh, good. This seems like another opportunity to diminish Smaug. Have him just have this tiny little densely packed, entirely built out of wood town, and have him being flying back and forth over it, lighting like one little lighting like, you know, setting fire to the bridges first, and you know, like just lighting teeny bits, you know, lighting something on fire that then falls over into the water and goes out, and jeez, having a horrible time starting the fire.
Now, well, like, we do need to remember that Smaug's attack is going to be the next episode.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. We'll talk more about Smaug's attack next time.
It's not anticipated too much.
Yeah.
That's right. We will have plenty of kindling to talk about.
But I don't know. I am not. The big problem that I have here is that where we're left at the end of film two, you know, and it may well be that nothing comes of this and that we just have, you know, either, you know, pretty close to immediately after where we ended film two, Smaug appears in the sky over Lake Town and he says to the guards, the dragon's here, you want to let me out? And they're like, yeah, okay, maybe that happens. Maybe the building gets smashed and he escapes through the smashed building or something. Either of those things are possible, but neither of those things picks up on what seems to be left us as the situation. I mean, we have Toriel and those dwarves still there in town. We have, like, there are several factors that are left. I mean, if you think about Lake Town, we're left with four Lake Town related loose ends at the very end of The Desolation of Smaug. One is Bard sitting in prison asking, hey, really, the dragon is coming, you should let me out. The other is Toriel and the dwarves back at his house with his daughters. What are they going to be doing and how are they going to be involved? The third is his son, Bane, at large somewhere in the city with the Black Arrow. What's he going to do and how is he going to reconnect with his father in order to give him the last remaining Black Arrow? And fourth, you have Legolas riding off across the bridge after Bolg, who may or may not still be within sight of Lake Town when the dragon attacks.
Which, by the way, let me just put in this note that Gerald made, which I hadn't thought of. Where did Legolas get the horse? Are there more horses in the Lake Town stable that might show up in the next movie? Just Just a little side note that I thought was interesting.
That's true.
I hadn't thought of that until Gerald brought that up.
Do we know for a fact that he didn't bring a horse?
I don't know how he could have. They were on foot when they had left the Elven King's Hall. They couldn't very well go back and get horses, right?
Because I was just thinking about that, prompted by some of the comments and the questions. You know, basically people were asking, how on earth, how did the entire team of orcs and the two elves get into Lake Town without anyone noticing? Like, you know, it seems
the intensive spy network
down.
Really was having a bad night.
Well, and it seems pretty locked down, given what Bard had to do to get the dwarves in, and then these guys just show up, and they weren't even on a boat. What the? I'm
and
hoping there's some
come
kind
across
of
that bridge or something. You know, the bridge that he rides out on.
I'm hoping there's some kind of missing scene that will be on the extended edition.
I'm sure that's it.
You show reeds, you know, coming up out of the lake. You know, as yes. they walk across
they
the bottom
swim.
Of the lake. Yeah.
That's right. Yana says they crawl in one by one through other people's toilets.
That's right, I forgot about that. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like that's exactly, that is definitely how Peter Jackson would depict elves in his film, doing something like that.
Crawling up through toilets? Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Tom says, well, Legolas obviously walked in on the lake.
Right, sure, yeah, he just walked across the surface of the lake.
So he could have brought a horse, but does Tariel also have a horse? It's very confusing.
Yeah, no, probably not.
The film, as we saw in theaters, those kinds of scenes strike me as they give me. I'm sure there's maybe missing scenes that explain things, but those scenes, when I think back on them, strike me as kind of sloppy filmmaking. Where it's like, oh, and here's where Legolas rides off on a horse. Where did he get a horse? Who cares?
Right.
The audience isn't going to ask that question.
But see, the thing is that actually, you know, the Lord of the Rings films were quite good at avoiding that kind of thing. I mean,
yeah.
Internal consistency of the film was something that was, I think, really a hallmark of Jackson's earlier films, which is why, you know, Dave, it does seem to me, as you were suggesting, to be possibly an editing issue rather than a conception issue. I doubt, you know, that, like, you know, Jackson and Boyens and Fran Walsh and, you know, John Howe and Alan Lee were all sitting around, you know, and then they're like, he needs a horse. He didn't have one. Well, screw it. Who cares? Like, I can't see them having that conversation. They have always cared about that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I'm sure.
And now we're back to the hopeful, you know, hoping for, you know, good stuff in the extended edition conversation.
The extended edition gets longer and longer every episode we have.
Yep.
I mean, it would be nice if they did pay attention to that, because it is troublesome anyway. So Legolas is leaving Lake Town, and if we're figuring the timing being, you know, being what it is, that he basically is fighting Bolg at the same time that the dragon is kind of, you know, futzing around on the mountain, then he's not going to have gone very far before the dragon shows up.
Right.
Like, well, you said, he could get to Dalgan's
especially if Bolg applies the Radagast the Brown strategy for leading him away.
Right.
He's just going to run around in the field outside of Lake Town.
Right, exactly.
You know, a note that Brian made about them having done an extra movie, it's like, imagine what would have gotten left out of this is day two movies.
Right. I wanted to actually address that for a second, because it's one of the things that has really sort of annoyed me about the people who, you know, have just been, especially since the announcement of the three films, have been, you know, really without even waiting to see the films, just been saying, oh, see, this is obviously just a ploy and it's all going to be padded and useless. People who say, see, like, they've just added a whole bunch of padding in order to add a third film in order to make more money, like just not paying any attention at all. Like the problem they have been having from the beginning has not been, oh crap, we've got to find some more stuff to shove in here in order to make it longer to make a film. I mean, this thing has been overpacked from day one. and you can say, like, that's the problem that the second film has is not like, boy, we were really spreading butter over too much bread here to make this fit into, you know, into a third film. Rather, the problem that it has is there are places where it feels like a jumbled mess because there's so much stuff they couldn't squeeze it all in. So again, I get really annoyed when people talk that way, because again, it's just like they're just not paying attention. That is so obviously not what we're seeing on screen. Is something that's simply been padded and stretched.
Yep, that's very true.
Anyway, I just had to vent there for a second. I'm better. back to our loose ends. So I said we've got the four loose ends. And how do we see them being involved again here in the lead? You know, we'll talk about the battle itself and Smaug's actual attack next time, and the immediate and the aftermath of that attack. But here again, like, where are we left at the beginning? If none of these things happen, you know, so we have these four pieces in place, you know, Bard in prison, his son at large, the dwarves and Toriel back at his house with Bard's daughters, and Legolas galloping away on the mystery horse. If in the end, Smaug just shows up and starts smashing the place and Bard escapes or is released in the confusion, that seems to me a serious missed opportunity. I know I left the film with the clear impression that where we were going to start was going to be in the time before Smaug arrives, or even after he's spotted, you know, and before he swoops in and begins his attack. We need a jailbreak. I mean, we've got to get Bard, you know, Bard needs to escape from prison, and it's rather urgent. And here we have all of these other, you know, protagonists there in town.
Who are quite capable, in fact.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, so here's a question. Let's see. Would they have the impetus to try and break him out before they spot the dragon? Or do you think... So I'm imagining... Bane knows what's going on, right? Like he talked to Bard long enough that they knew that they need to get the Black Arrow, and he's hiding it and stuff, so he knows what's going on.
Yes.
Bard's daughters, are they savvy? Are they hip? Did they feel the earthquake and say, "Up, oh, Dad warned us this would happen. That's the dragon. We got to get him out of jail. Help us, elf woman." Will the dwarves and Toriel? I mean, it's hard to imagine Toriel. I'm sure she would feel the earthquake, but it's like, does she know what the context? Does she even know about the dragon? Like, those characters, that group, I'm really interested in. Do they have enough knowledge about circumstances to know how to act?
Well, the obvious thing that could here's a sort of obvious opening scene. You know, we have dwarves and Toriel with Kiwi stretched out on the table. Tableau. And now we return to that scene and we have, you know, Bane comes barging in the door holding the Black Arrow and saying, "They've taken Dad!" That it could happen. Right. And so then we have a rallying together of all of the loose ends other than Legolas. To go out and take swift and immediate action with or without Kiwi. I don't know exactly how efficacious Toriel's healing was, if he can spring up off the table and go off into battle right away or not. But in any case, certainly some, at the very least, some or most of the dwarves and Toriel could go and help Bane and possibly Bard's daughters. I would quite like to see Bard's daughters turn out to be competent in the way you were suggesting, Dave.
It would be nice,
you know, to see them, and I think, you know, even with the orcs at the end, you know, they certainly did more than just scream and look vulnerable. They did that too, but they did more than that also. So, you know, one could hope for good things from them, maybe. But yeah, I think then even if Smaug is sighted again, I still think there's going to be a. There's got to be a pre-battle sequence. I mean, I think if that doesn't happen, I know I will be disappointed. I'll definitely feel like something was sort of left on the table if that doesn't happen.
Well, it certainly would be So here's the thing: it would be a huge waste of the other characters because once the attack begins and Bard's out of prison, the rest of them have nothing to do, right? Like, what good are the dwarves going to be? Zero. Tariel, for all her capability, what is she going to do? Nothing. You know, all they could possibly do is scamper around and pull people out of fires. I guess that's something, but they can't help at all in terms of the dragon. They're going to be useless. The only person who could potentially be useful, as pointed out by Ryan, is Legolas. In fact, I completely agree with Ryan now. Legolas has to not be at Lake Town. Given precedent set for him in previous films, Smaug doesn't stand a chance against Legolas.
Right? Right. He never misses.
Right.
Yeah. Smaug, Legolas will be like, oh, no, no problem, guys. Niche, boom, dead.
But he...
I guess you could argue he doesn't have his giant
exactly
Galathrim bow that he had
in
Lord of the Rings.
He doesn't have it. I mean, even his bigger bow. I mean, they were setting it up, and certainly the way that they visually depicted it—that is the scale of Smaug, the size of
him—does
make it really unlikely that a regular sized arrow would be able to kill him. I mean, it would just be a very small wound. Even if it hit him in just the right place, doubtless Legolas's archery is sufficiently precise to perform acupuncture on the dragon, but what else could it do? I mean, it's very...
Next episode,
yeah. But anyway, that is to say, I think that they've invested enough in film two. They've invested enough in the necessity of the Black Arrow, and there I think this is where I think they're protected against the Legolas factor or the Tauriel factor, frankly, for that matter, by changing the nature of the Black Arrow, by turning the Black Arrow from just a regular arrow, which was black and special, by turning that into a different form of weaponry altogether, into a special kind of thing which could hurt the dragon because it was much larger and more powerful. I think they've made Smaug thereby Legolas and Tauriel proof. Because it doesn't matter how accurate they are, their weapons are incapable of damaging him enough.
They did say, didn't they? Wasn't the point made that only the Black Arrow could pierce the skin?
Yeah, because it's the only thing that's. And again, the way that they, you know, physicalized that, instead of making it some kind of, some kind of fated or sort of mystic thing, or prophesied thing or something like that, they made that a purely mechanical thing, right? Only. This kind of weapon, only this kind of missile shot from that kind of weapon, is large, strong, and powerful enough to pierce his hide and kill him. And again, seeing the size of Smaug, it is very easy to believe that, a regular arrow taking him down.
One of the very first things we see in Lake Town is the windlass on top of the
right.
master's hunters, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I think narratively, I know. Several of our listeners are not sold on the windlass and still are pining for, like, oh, maybe he'll miss with the windlass again, and then he'll pull out his bow, and he'll, I think narratively, and of course visually, that's just not going to work.
I think for
what they've set up, it will be anticlimactic and disappointing to the viewing audience. Not to you people, Riddles in the Dark listeners, who are well versed in the lore, and but to everybody else, it'll be weird and anticlimactic. It'll be a betrayal of our expectations. I if he doesn't kill Smaug with the windlass.
Hey, not having Bard, if they're not going to have Bard kill the dragon with the windlass, they might as well keep Thorin alive at the end. Per the petition.
Yeah, so you're just sort of drawing a like an absurdity parallel there, right?
Yes. Okay. I mean, it's like you have to have one. By the way, that petition showed up on the Tolkien Society Facebook page, and the members of the page have turned it into like the longest running thread. They call it the deathless Thorin thread of silliness. That was their reaction to it. They just like took it and just ran with it, and just like they talk about everything under this one thread. It just keeps going on and on and on.
Yeah, no, it's that is such a touchingly misguided idea, but
I know.
Or misguidedly anyway. Touching idea or something, but
so the thing is that then I'm back to sort of back to the topic of this particular episode.
Yes.
I just don't see, I mean, I could see us. Okay, the one thing I was going to say, David mentioned earlier that he had thought maybe we might roll back in time. And actually talking about the earthquake and that kind of thing, I could see them maybe rolling back to that.
Yeah.
To the earthquake, you know, where we see that maybe from some other different viewpoints. And then going forward, because it's not that much time, I don't think, from the earthquake to the time that Smaug is going to be sighted coming their way.
Probably not, no. But we still could have, because see, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me like we can get the effect of time dilation as well as time compression at times in these films.
Yes,
you know. So, for instance, Smaug is rampaging after us. Let's go down to the forges and start a long and complex process. Balin is going to make exploding grenades and stuff. Like, yeah, give me 15 seconds. I can whip up some grenades. But again, like...
That's right. And then 15 seconds takes 3 minutes of screen time.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I don't think that the fact that Smaug is already on the way, you know, that basically we did see Lake Town with the glow on the mountainside, which I'd forgotten the glow on the mountainside also. I remember the earthquake, but forgot the glow. But anyway, yeah, so even given that we've seen Lake Town with Smaug already clearly in the air on the way down, that doesn't mean that there isn't plenty of time for some more scenes to happen. Now, I mean... It does mean we don't have time for, like, you know, a careful consultation. You know, Ban comes in and says, what will we do? And Toriel's like, let's sit down and talk about this for a long time. I mean, we don't have time for that. But do we have time for them to run out of Bard's house and go over and, essentially assault the prison to set Bard free before the dragon arrives? I think so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we definitely have time for that sequence.
The more I think about it, the more I think we have at least the same, at least the amount of time covered by from the moment of the first earthquake and the first see the glow. So like that last instant in time that we had Bard in the prison, we have from then until Smaug's arrival, and I can see them stretching that out because I think it will be more dramatic if someone spots him, or if there's like a slow dawning on the people of Lake Town that the dragon's coming, that, you know, somebody spots movement on the mountain and then they start seeing something off in the distance flying through the sky, and you allow, as opposed to it just being like, oh god, there's fire coming down us from the sky out of nowhere, totally unexpected.
Right.
Instead have people have this slow
yeah.
build of dread. You know,
first they think it's a thrush, then they think it's a raven.
I would really like to see. I'd like to see, you know, like Alfred knocking on the master's door, saying, we're getting some odd reports of like, something in the sky, or even Alfred coming and saying, they broke Bard out of prison, and it's starting with that, starting with like
yes.
Lake you know, the master calling all his forces together to capture the escaped prisoner, and the you know, and then the reports starting to come in saying like, there's a giant thing in the sky flying towards us, and seeing the master initially be dismissive and being like, oh come on, great, and then it becomes more and more obvious, oh crap, there's a dragon coming. The master continuing in his denial, saying, "Well, I don't care. You know, task number one is recapture Bard." And some of the guards saying, "Are you nuts? We're not doing that. There's a dragon coming." Like, and maybe there's not enough screen time for all of that, but that would be kind of cool. Like, a nice right. Little sort of slow build.
As Brian says, "Bard's escaped from prison, and also we're all going to die." Yeah. One thing that I think, you know, we got a taste of this. But I hope it was only a foretaste and not the only taste we're going to get. The scene in the book where people are looking up at the glow, the golden glow on the side of the mountain and saying, the king under the mountain is forging gold, and people are misinterpreting it and starting to cheer, and Bard, the grim-voiced man, is the one who stands up and says, you know, you fools, it's the dragon, and he's the one who warns them, and he's, you know, saying, to arms, and he, like, steps forth and rallies the people. And thus, the dragon did not find them entirely unprepared.
Oh,
now,
that
see,
on that scene,
I have an alternate view of that, which is that Bard is still in prison at the time that they sight the dragon, and he is frustrated because not only is he right, has he right, you know, he's like he called it, but he also is like powerless. He's still stuck in the jail and he can't get out. I mean, I could see that happening where there's a few seconds of that before somebody shows up to spring him.
Right. Now, as I said, we got a foretaste of that. I mean, like, when the earthquake happens and stuff, you know, Bard speaking to the jailers, right? You know, we already had Bard saying, like, the dragon's coming, you know, I really need to get out of here. But again, I hope that that's not the only taste of that that we get. Because remember, in the book, what this leads up to is it's not just the fact that Bard stands and fights to the last and shoots the dragon and kills him that leads everybody to say King Bard, King Bard. He's already taken leadership. You know, we see him rallying the people. He's already acting like a king and hero even before his last miraculous shot.
Yes.
And
we need to see the disintegration of the current leadership structure.
Yes.
Sort of their abdication of their responsibility for the defense.
Because the master's going to lose it, right? I mean, he's going to lose. He's just not going to know what to do and be all...
I do kind of agree with you, Corey. I actually, the more I think about it, I don't know how it'll work on screen, but I would like some rendition of that exact thing, the of Bard the Grim-Faced Man saying, you idiots, it's not the treasure, it's the dragon. I would like to see a confrontation between the master and Alfred and Bard in front of the people before the dragon arrives. Like, one last thing where it looks like, you know, where essentially maybe Bard is cornered, and then you catastrophically, the dragon shows up and no longer will they arrest Bard. Oh, you're free to go. Congratulations. There's a dragon.
Thinking about the timing of this, you know, what I wonder is, again, you know, because there's time for a jailbreak sequence, I think, before Smaug really arrives and starts to attack in earnest. But here's what I'm wondering. If the master's going to be distracted by the arrival of the dragons, the dragon will be spotted and we'll come in, maybe there'll be some, so maybe we'll get a shot of, you know, the people of Lake Town, like, you know, waking and looking out their windows and coming out and staring up in terror, and the master there, you know, and them looking to him for leadership and him not knowing what to do, or you know, him even getting caught sneaking away maybe by the people, and, you know, and then Bard comes in like a U catastrophe. You know, Bard has been released from prison. You know, the jailbreak has happened, and then Bard comes in and, like, in that moment provides that sort of leadership and rallies the people to fight while the master is slinking away. I think that the timing I would think of that sequence could be that we could have first a jailbreak sequence, then a not just a Bard sprinting across Lake Town to the Windlass and never talking to anybody, but enough time for Bard to be released to, you know, to
command.
Yeah, to take some kind of command, to be, you know, to be that contrast again in the book. You know, the contrast which was so sharp and so important to the people of Lake Town, and which has also been set up in the film. You know, the contrast between how the Master responds to the dragon's arrival and how Bard responds to the dragon's arrival. And I think that we're still going to need that. We're still going to need to see that. Remember, we're ultimately, I assume, going to be leading up to, you know, an army of people from Lake Town in funny helmets marching on the Lonely Mountain, presumably under the leadership of Bard. And so, you know, how are we going to get there from here? And there has to be a real change in leadership. As much as the people might seem to respect Bard, you know, when he steps out from among them and speaks his piece in the town square, they're not following him. I mean, he's not in fact a rabble rouser, despite the master's fears. So we have to get there, and I think that has to be through not just the fact of killing the dragon, but acts of leadership and apparent, you know, bravery during the fight. So anyway, I do think that there's sort of an opportunity for those two separate sequences.
We should probably move on to the riddle. What do you think? I mean, it's still kind of in keeping with what we're talking about.
Yeah. We can do that. And the riddle kind of picks up on the four loose ends that I was talking about. So,
right.
Yeah. So, Trish, you want to explain?
Yes. Yes. So we've kind of been talking about this, and some of the listeners have already even given their own answers to the riddle. How will Bard escape prison? Not when, but how will he escape prison? A, he escapes on his own. B, the dwarves get him out, perhaps with help from Tauriel. So either the dwarves by themselves or the dwarves with Tauriel. C, Bard's son gets him out. D, a combination of B and C. So Bard's son and the dwarves with or without Tauriel together get him out. Or E, none of the above. And none of the above covers some of the ones we've talked about. You know, some folks in the comments have said, you know, Alfred may spring him. The Master may get him out voluntarily. Tauriel by herself might. So there's still some possibilities. It's just that we could have gone on to, like, you know, M in our choices in terms of all the lists of people. So
Legolas might return.
Legolas might return. Bolg may accidentally get him out. So we just felt, you know, that these four, he escapes on his own, the dwarves get him out, with or without Tauriel, Bard's son gets him out, or the combination of dwarves and Bard's son, seemed the most likely, and then E kind of covers a bunch of other possibilities that could conceivably happen.
Okay.
Right? Is that good? Did I do good?
Yeah. So the question is, the question to me is, what is going to be the sort of the overall narrative, you know, thrust of that scene? That is to say, is this going to be Bard and the dwarves and Tauriel working together? Because that's something that has implications far beyond the mere fact of the release of Bard from prison, right? So again, in trying to think about this, I'm trying to think of the whole big picture. Because this is, you know, I assume this is going to happen near the very beginning of the film, if not at the very opening of the film. This is going to be happening very soon. I've already forgotten what I voted for last week and how the film starts. I have this policy, strict policy, of completely forgetting about my votes almost as soon as I give them.
Do you want to know, or do you want to stay in mystery?
What did I say? Did I say Dol Guldur?
Let me go look. I'll go look.
That's what I was thinking just now, but my mind changes all the time. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So,
yep.
I did?
You did.
Okay, good.
Dol Guldur.
Okay. All right, very good. Anyway, so somewhere near the very beginning.
Apparently I picked E. I don't remember.
None of the above.
None of the above.
What the heck was I thinking?
Well, you were going for the offices of Grub, Grub, and Burrows.
That's right.
Oh, yes. That's right. Yes, I was going with my wishful thinking.
That's right. Which is always the best policy.
Yeah.
But anyway, so if we have near the very beginning of the film some dwarves, an elf of Lake Town, working together to rescue Bard, who seems destined to be the captain of one of the armies in the, you know, one of the armies initially ranged against Thorin, and the dwarves in the mountain. That has serious implications. You can avoid that by having Bard either escape on his own or having his son rescue him independently. Bane is kind of the dark horse, I think, in this, because he vanished, but he's at large. He has to be reconnected with Bard because he's got the arrow, right? So he and Bard have to reconnect somehow and somewhere. And, you know, it would be kind of cool. It would be kind of a kind of touching for Bane to be the one who springs him. You know, by some method or other, that would be fun. That would be fun. And that would also have the effect of having Bard be in no way indebted to the dwarves. Because remember, you know, Bard is strongly in the anti-dwarf camp. I mean, what has been set up so forcibly by that showdown in the town square with Thorin and the Master is the fact that he already is blaming Thorin and the dwarves for rousing the dragon against them before it's even happened, right? Once the dragon actually does go down to Lake Town and destroy the town and kill lots of people, there, you know, now the fury that Bard already had worked up in the second film is going to be even higher. So the idea that Bard is going to be out for blood and ready to, like, do a punitive strike against Thorin, you know, with much more animus against him than he had in the book, we're ready for that. I mean, that's already there. So again, if the dwarves rescue him, that complicates that. And, you know, that might be a good thing, that might be a bad thing, but it does definitely complicate it.
Yeah, you know, I originally had been sort of tending toward the dwarves breaking him out, because my thought had been, what the heck are they there for, after all? You know, why are they in Lake Town, after all? And we do have, you know, Feely and Keely, assuming Keely is functional, and Beaufort, who, you know, are very acrobatic, and they did that whole thing about getting into the armory to get the weapons, so they've demonstrated that. So kind of that was kind of where my head was going. So as you're talking, I totally get it. I mean, I'm wavering that direction, but then I'm thinking, okay, so what are the dwarves going to be doing? I mean, why are they there? Are they just going to watch and sort of, you know, be, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure. I could see, you know, where our D, where Bane is maybe the one who comes to the dwarves and says, come help me get my father out, you know, kind of thing. Maybe he kind of leads the charge and the dwarves help him. That would probably be the best compromise in my mind for how
because
my head's been
do the dwarves and, I mean, Toriel obviously doesn't know what's going on because she just arrived, but do the dwarves and Bard's daughters even know he's in prison? I mean, Bane is the only one who knows he's been taken, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right.
So
they still think he's out, right? He left to go do something, didn't he? When he left his home.
What did he? Was he going to the Windlass? Was he going to man the Windlass? Is that what he left to do?
I can't remember. Yeah. Dave, you've watched this thing over and over and over, haven't you? Go watch it again. Yes. Let us know.
Yeah, he takes the arrow.
Yes, to go to the Windlass. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then when he realizes they're out to get him, he hands the arrow to Bane and says, hide this. And
yeah.
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 So basically we need Bane to go back to the house and tell them what's going on.
Yeah, I think maybe I'm going for that combo of B and C. I mean, I just can't imagine.
I imagine Bane breaking him out by himself.
And I'm thinking, I think we've said this before, when it comes to the siege, we've theorized that these dwarves that are left in Lake Town may actually end up being more sympathetic to the people and be trying to speak on their behalf to Thorin. That is not going to work, but that may be the role they have.
Especially given Philippa Boyan's recent comments.
We can talk about
them. Yeah, as soon as we can talk about that. Dave, do you want to summarize them?
Yeah, basically, she talked about leaving some dwarves behind, you know, the big change from the book, and I think that the narrative reasons were twofold. One, because they wanted there to be some characters that we've spent time with. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Here's a quote from it from Pete. We made the decision so we'd experience the attack on Lake Town through the eyes of people we've come a long way with. We wanted some of the dwarves to understand what happened in that firestorm, the Holocaust that rains down upon Lake Town. Beaufort, James Nesbitt, comes more into his own in the third film. A rift begins to open up, and I can't say much more without going into spoilers for film three, but it's primarily because we needed him to be there when the dragon attacks. So basically, we called it. There's going to be a faction of dwarves that are anti-Thorin. Anti-crazy Thorin.
Pro-Lake Town.
Yeah, well, I mean, that pretty much confirms what we assumed was being...
set up.
Yeah, set up. So yeah, she's confirmed that what we concluded was obvious is in fact the case. In other words, that the different factions at the Siege of the Lonely Mountain are going to be, each one of them, divided in various different ways.
But I think the other thing we can conclude from this is that in the scenes leading up to the dragon attack and during the dragon attack, there is going to be some serious dwarf screen times, specifically Beaufort.
Yeah, well, I mean, that seems sort of inevitable. And we can come back, and that's a question that we will discuss in our next episode. You know, what will the dwarves be doing during the Battle of Lake Town? But...
So, I mean, back to this riddle. I mean,
yeah,
I could then see
that's exactly
dwarves
taking
some part in it. You know, but I'm actually tending maybe toward the combination, because I just can't imagine Bane being left out of the jailbreak scene. I would think he would be part of it.
Well, there seems like there would be no way for them to know he's even in prison.
Right, exactly, without Bane.
Nor to understand, I mean, maybe his daughters would understand this, but it seems like Bane is the person in possession of the key knowledge. If indeed Bard is going to escape from prison without just simply watching the prison burn down and then, like, jumping in the water.
Right.
If he's going to be broken out before the dragon attacks, the only person who has all of the knowledge necessary for that to occur is Bane.
Yeah.
He's the one that knows... He's the one that's fully privy to what's going on and what Bard needs to do to defend the town. And he's the only one, on top of that, amongst the protagonists, who knows that Bard's been taken and has been imprisoned. The only other thing you could imagine is there's a change of heart on behalf of, like, one of the guards or Alfred or somebody to say, maybe we should let Bard out. But so it seems like Bane has to be involved, even if it's just to go back and say, hey guys, Bard's in prison, and then maybe at that point the dwarves and Tauriel say, okay, we'll get him out. Bane, you stay here and take care of your sisters. You're not coming.
You know, one version of the non-jailbreak scenario that I would like, in general, I feel like the jailbreak scenario kind of has to happen. But the one thing that would be cool would be, I mean, all we saw was Bard just saying, like, hey, come on, let me out. Like, you don't understand what's about to happen. And the guards kind of ignoring him. If Bard were actually to win the guards over, you know, like, say somebody spies the dragon or something, or you know, if we get like a speech from Bard, you know, basically calling the guards to their senses and like, what are you doing? Like, you know, obeying the master, you know, the master who doesn't care about any of this stuff and doing these, you know, and the dragon's coming and we have to take action. Like, if basically Bard, because Bard, Bard was a member of, I mean, he was involved. I mean, he was like a captain in Lake Town. You know, he was like a military captain in Lake Town. In the book, he was clearly a leader of the resistance. You know, he was the center of the resistance against Smaug. Whereas Bard, though he's respected and though he's the only one sort of with a spine in Lake Town, as I said, he's not somebody who people obey. You know, he's not in command of anybody in Lake Town. So I could stomach a non-jailbreak scenario if it is, like, basically Bard kind of taking charge. You know, if he, like, delivers a speech to the guards that really gets through to them and they become, like, from then on, Bard is essentially, you know, the de facto captain of the guard, and they're now following him instead of the master, and that becomes, you know, sort of the turning point of, you know, the people of Lake Town to choose to follow Bard instead of the master, which is what then leads to the resistance against Smaug and ultimately to that. I mean, I kind of... I would, in some ways, like to see Bard not fighting against Smaug as a rogue solitary figure, but to see him being a leader of the people of Lake Town.
Now, listen, Andy Higgins has a very good argument for Bane being the one to break his dad out.
Yeah.
He said Bane's name comes from the Old Norse meaning mover, so he could move his dad out of prison. I mean, what better than a philological argument?
There you go. There it is. Yep. I'm convinced. I'm totally convinced. I'm totally convinced.
So there
convinced.
You go.
Yep.
We're done.
Yep.
Okay. Goodbye, folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't top that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I'm going to go with the combo. I've decided I'm going with the combo, which is...
Hey, Trish, let's post the... let's post the...
Well, do you want to say what we're going to do before we do it, or you want people to vote before we say? I mean,
no, let's just post it so that everybody can see the options to make sure everyone is reminded of them.
Well, posting it also opens up the...
Yeah, I know. That's okay. We can... people can vote. Okay. Our the very first vote we got was for Bane.
That was that was probably Andy.
Andy was quick on the trigger there.
Plausible none of the above's can we imagine.
Oh, a lot, actually.
There's like a third of the people voting for that. I'm really curious.
Well,
to
I think this one about talking a guard into springing him, I think, is an E. That's not him breaking out of prison on his own. That's him influencing a random passerby.
You voted for E. Post what your theory is in the thing.
Yes, yes. Special, of course, you don't have to.
Vote E, a dragon blast breaks him out, okay?
Okay, yeah, two people, the first two people, both Brian and David were suggesting that. Okay.
And then Luke.
Acid Alfred the Dragon busts the jail.
Luke saw Corey is totally stealing my E premise, which was, oh gosh, Luke, what was it? I can't remember what Corey said now.
The first swoop. But don't you think, don't people feel like if Bard just kind of happens to get out of prison because the dragon burned it down or knocked it down, that seems so... like dramatically boring. I'm sorry.
That's about the least satisfying scenario I can imagine. Like, I'm not saying that it's necessarily the least likely, but it seems the least narratively satisfying scenario.
It seem like something Peter Jackson would do? Doesn't he seem to invest more in his characters? Like, wouldn't he want to go the character route?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Anthony Campbell, that is the one thing, that is the one I think really interesting possibility.
Leave everybody in suspense.
what if they make us think Bard's dead?
And then he emerges from the rubble just like he emerges from the lake.
From the lake?
You know, in the book.
I can see that.
Maybe. I can't believe nobody has voted for B, the dwarves breaking him out.
Oh, that's what I'm picking.
Me too.
Are you?
Yeah, me too. I'm totally going for that too.
Well,
sentimentally,
we still have 35% haven't voted, so 35%.
Sentimentally, I love C. And there's a part of me, though I have to admit, it's kind of like the perverse part that is always cheering for extraordinarily unlikely things. But that part of me really wants to see the emergence of Bane, son of Bard, as a proto-hero here, you know, who, like, comes in and rescues his dad, and then, you know, the two of them, you know, so it's like a family thing, because, you know, they're both the descendants of Geryon. Remember, Bane was the one who was speaking of the tradition that Geryon hit the dragon, and, you know, he was the one who talked about the loose scale and everything, so, you know, you can totally, you know, get into the, like, the line of Geryon redeems, you know, the fact that Geryon couldn't shoot the dragon, you know, failed to shoot the dragon. You know, there's a lot of ways in which I find that really compelling, and I really, really like it. But, yeah.
I really like Noam Weiss's theory.
Okay, what is it?
I have some theories. One of them is this. Based on you know, time compression and you know, the fact that they play with time in the films, Bard is put to trial, sentence, serves his time, and is released from prison. Bard is released on parole.
He's released on parole before the dragon gets there. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yep. Well, we keep saying, you know, time and distance don't mean all that much in Peter Jackson films.
Also, those of you voting for E and then saying your theory is that during the course of the dragon attack, Bard will escape because it gets destroyed or whatever, wouldn't that count as A?
I don't think so. I mean, the escaping... Yeah. Well,
I would think escapes on his own would mean, like, he...
Picks the lock,
or bonks a guard on the head and steals the keys.
He convinces the dog holding.
I was just going to say that. He does look like what's his name? Will, what's his name? Right. So that would be a good Pirates of the Caribbean. Fic. Will Turner.
For the record, for B, I personally think Bane will be sort of involved in the sense that he will go back to the house and tell them that Bard needs to be broken out. But I think that it seems very irresponsible for them to take him along.
He may insist on going on his own. I mean, he may insist.
Well, somebody's got to stay back and keep an eye on Keeley, right?
Assuming Kiwi doesn't spring up off the table.
Yeah, I'm thinking he's going to spring up off the table.
That's true. He has been magically healed.
Yeah.
I don't know. We've got, we're 5 minutes in and 72% have voted. That could mean that there's just folks that have departed or whatever. Shall I close it and share the results?
Well, there is this.
No, it's
there,
okay.
I think there are some, like, vestigial logins my disastrous first attempt to log in.
Well, let's see. I know we're still getting a couple more votes here. I would specify. I would specify in order to distinguish between B and D. I would specify. Bane has to come along. Bane has to be there at the jailbreak.
Right.
If he comes back and says they've got Dad in prison, and you know Toriel and Beaufort are like, okay, stay here with your sisters. We'll go get him.
Right.
Then the answer is B. It's not D.
I agree. I agree, but I think Bane's actually going to be with them. He's going to either be a lookout, or he's going to have to show them where the jail is. You know, so I think he'll be with them.
Ah, they've already cased the joint. No, no.
So you guys are going with B, right? Both of you are.
Well, I'm still kind of wavering. I'm like 75% B, but I'm like 25% wanting C. You know, C is the.
What?
C is the one I would love to have.
You're picking C over... I mean, if I didn't go B, I would just go D. For me, it's just a question of whether Bane goes along with the dwarves.
Well, but Andy's argument was it's sort of the father-son thing, kind of cool.
Exactly. You know? The line of Gurion, man. You know, this is the redemption of the line of Gurion.
Yeah, but then you get the... Then basically you have the dwarves doing nothing, which just doesn't seem to... I don't know. I can't imagine them...
There's still the other things they could do.
Sit around. they're playing poker back in
Map out the escape routes, you know. They can... there are definitely things they could be doing. I can't think of them at this particular moment, but they certainly exist.
Taking some naked baths in the...
No,
in the
my... My main deliberation between B and C is not between which answer I believe more probable, but rather which answer I believe to be
you prefer.
More,
oh,
more
go
cool.
with your heart, Corey.
Yeah,
this has worked so well in the past, Corey. Go for it.
Exactly. Go with my heart because it has never led me astray before.
Churning out those certificates like crazy.
Though I still hold out that the craziest answer that I ever gave was correct. My Thran is still alive, living and uncaptured, living as a hermit answer is still looking good. I gotta say, it's still looking good. But, no, I'm going to go with B.
You're going to go with B?
I'm going to go with B. And I don't think Bandage is going to be left behind at the house. Here's my reconciliation. My reconciliation of my heart and my head. My head tells me the dwarves and Toriel are going to break him out of jail. My heart wants Bane to be really involved and to see the whole redemption of the line of Gurion. So, here's the scenario. Ben comes back and says, they've got Dad in prison, and they're like, okay, we'll go rescue him. But he, remember, Ben has been left as the custodian of the Black Arrow. He's the one who has, you know, he's been told to keep it safe. That is his sacred duty. So he is going to take the Black Arrow to the Windlass and await
Meet
his father
at the
there.
Windlass.
Yes. He's going to, so, you know, his job is to keep the Black Arrow safe and to get it to the Windlass. They're not going to bring it with them to the prison, you know, because they don't want to jeopardize it. So he's still given it a task, and, you know, a difficult and dangerous task. Make your way without getting caught to the Windlass, and keep the Black Arrow there in preparation for your father's arrival. We'll go get him and we'll send him over to you, and then you shoot the dragon, ready, break. So he has a role, and we still get the, like, redemption of the line of Geryon. You know, you have, like, Geryon's younger descendant handing the Black Arrow to his father, Geryon's older descendant, and, you know, and they shoot the arrow, like, and have, like, a little father-son high-five redemption of the line of Geryon when the dragon is killed. That can still happen without Ban being the one to break him out of prison, so I say, there we go.
And just remember, your vote is not binding. This is just... This is kind of a little perk of you guys, you know, dialing in to listen to, or coming, joining us live to listen today. But your final vote in September is the one that's going to count.
No, but we wrote down. We're writing down each and one of your names. if you change your answer, we will mock you for it. No, we're not.
That means you can't change your answers. That's terrible.
I'm not going to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ironically, Ryan says, ironically, the dwarves are back at Bard's place trying to make a fire to keep warm, to warm Peely Dry.
yeah. Actually, in an extreme instance of irony, the dwarves accidentally set fire to Lake Town. And it turns out by the time Smaug gets there, it's already burned down.
By the way, on a completely unrelated note, I have to say, you know, we think about Smaug the Golden emerging from the mountain, and then he shakes off the gold. Think about, you know, there's like a whole field of gold nuggets there on the slopes of Erebor. Imagine one day somebody coming across that. Awesome.
The river is flowing with gold. You know, now you have the bed of the river, you know, they'll be panning, you know, the upper
That's
reaches
right.
of the of
There'll
the
be a whole
for...
gold rush.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
Oh yeah. Oh, because of Smaug's little.
Yeah, because he shuck it all off, and then it's all you're
true.
All going to turn
He's
into little nuggets.
Scattered it all over the Valley of the Desolation.
That's right. The decorations of Smaug.
That's true. Will they see like some kind of like? So what is time of day? Is this the middle of night, or is like
middle
sunrise
of night.
Coming?
Middle
soon?
Of night.
I think it's middle of the night.
Okay. Yep. I was gonna say. Would it be maybe the sun will start to peek up over the mountain, and then they'll see the sunlight reflecting off of the gold all that he's scattered all over the valley, and be like, "Look, look at the gold! We can see it reflecting." And then Farrell will be like, "Yeah, you don't see the giant shadow flying above it, you idiot."
Yeah. All right. Well, we're out of time, so we should.
By the way, Corey, did you see they want to coin another term, combining fanfic and critfic, like fan crit? basically being unnecessarily critical of fans. I think if you're reasoning about what was done in a film or what will be done in a film based on what you expect the audience reaction to be, I think that's still critfic.
But you know, if you're just being critical as a fan, that's a good thing. So, you know,
yes,
yeah, nothing wrong with fan. In fact,
no, but I think what they're getting at is my contention that, like, you know, oh, they would never do this because the average movie going fan would hate it or something, or wouldn't follow it or whatever.
Right. Right.
I get it. I'm walking a fine line, people. Okay, come on. I do think, you know, I think it's perfectly fair to comment when we're considering like a potential dramatic element, and if it seems to unnecessarily rely on people having seen the film or presupposes some knowledge or familiarity with the general Tolkien legendarium, I think it's reasonable to say that seems unlikely to me because I don't think that would work as a film element because, you know, like, you know, that seems like a poor choice for a, what should be a standalone film that doesn't require you to have read the book.
Right. I think that's right. Yeah, sure. I mean,
nice
I think
people.
I do think, you know, one can be too cautious in trying to avoid any scent of critfic. That is, it's critfic if you're saying, you know, I think Peter Jackson is just trying to, you know, appeal to 16-year-old boys, and so therefore that's why he did this. Again, that to me is much more about analysis of the film than it is about anticipation of what's going to happen. When you're trying to guess what's going to happen, you have to go on something, you know?
Right.
And so, Dave, exactly as you're saying, to say, here's what I believe, you know, I believe that this would or would not work successfully in a film. And so, therefore, I'm going to guess that they're going to choose to do the thing that is going to work well in a film rather than the thing that isn't, and so, therefore, I think they're going to do this. That I would not describe as critfic at all. Or even again, to be looking, as we've done before, looking back and saying, what are the tendencies that we've seen in the, you know, in the choices that Peter Jackson has made in times past, in the other films that he has made?
How might that
then inform what we guess he's going to be doing later on? And that, again, that's not critfic, that's analysis. You know, that's looking at what has been and you know, wondering if he's going to follow the same patterns.
Yeah, because one of my kind of rules of thumb, I suppose, or something that I use as a criterion, is Jackson, historically, through Lord of the Rings and into The Hobbit, and I have not seen his other films, but for all I know, King Kong, other ones, he's a suspense builder. He loves having edge of seat kind of, you know, there's a lot of that in the films. And so that's kind of one of my criteria, is that seems to be a pattern in the way that he develops his storylines. So I was wondering, I didn't know if that was critfic or if it was analysis. Sounds like maybe it could be analysis.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's perfectly legitimate. Again, remember that the whole central idea of critfic is that it's something that people do in order to essentially avoid doing analysis of the film. Like, it's critfic is always an easier way out. You know, instead of trying to explain, you know, you feel like something is bad, you know, you don't like something about a film, and instead of really trying to explain what makes it bad, what is it that's going on there, you just wave your hands at, you know, some factor that you're assuming either in its process of composition or in the motivations of the artist. that's where the real evil of critfic lies, in replacing analysis with sort of sketchy guesswork, which doesn't even really answer the question or address the issue.
And coming up with unknown, you know, guessing at motivations of Jackson that lie completely outside of the storytelling.
Right, exactly. I mean, this whole categorization was prompted by the people who were responding to The Desolation of Smaug saying, I thought that movie was really bad because they were just trying to make it into an action movie to appeal to teenage boys.
Yeah,
like, that's not an analysis of why it was bad. You haven't even shown and said anything about why it was bad, and you're just jumping to a guess about what motivated them to make it bad or to, you know. So that's the kind of thing that really. So again, it's okay to think about. To look at patterns of what an artist does, what might be motivating them. I mean, it's no different, you know, from saying, you know, from reading Tolkien and saying things like, you know, you can see the general trend in Tolkien's work of, you know, small hands doing the great tasks because they must. That's a trend, you know. So you can say Tolkien likes that theme. So, you know, we see that theme coming up again and again. If we were, you know, if we were doing a show like this between the release of The Two Towers and The Return of the King, it would be okay to, you know, refer back to that idea and say, I think Sam Gamgee might play a really big role in The Return of the King.
Yeah.
You know, that would not be critfic, but a perfectly good piece of analysis.
Or to one of the points that you make in your book about the dwarves being so clueless, you know, going into this adventure.
Right.
I suppose critfic could be something like, well, you know, obviously Tolkien didn't want to, you know, spend a lot of time fleshing out their motives, or, you know what I
right.
mean? That would, to
right.
me, would be critfic, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, we really should let people go. We've overstayed our time here. But I do want to end with one announcement. A lot of you have heard about this already, but I just wanted to make sure. We have officially opened enrollment for the summer classes at Mythgard this semester, and there's been a lot of enthusiasm already, and that's been really great. So, you know, I encourage you to take a look at those. The three classes that we're offering this coming summer, I'm doing my class on the Canterbury Tales, so I'm continuing my two-semester Chaucer class. That class, by the way, a lot of people have asked, it's not cumulative, there's not designed to be any kind of prereq or anything. It's a two-semester class only in the sense that, you know, I'm covering the sort of the earlier works in Chaucer's career in the first class, and, you know, his later work, the Canterbury Tales, in the second class, so... if you haven't taken the first one, it's okay. You can still take the Canterbury Tales class, which should be really great fun. We sort of finished last night, Troilus and Crusade. We didn't quite finish it. We'll come back to it again on Monday, but that's been really great, looking at Troilus and Crusade. I've been having so much fun doing that. Chaucer's longest complete work. But of course, the Canterbury Tales is incredible fun. So we're going to be, I'm really looking forward to looking at that next semester. Professor Amy Sturgis is also doing her Harry Potter class again. It's been over 2 years since she did her Harry Potter class. That was in the very second semester of our existence at Mythgard. A lot of people didn't know we existed back then. So people have another chance. Amy Sturgis is actually, did you know, Dave, that Amy Sturgis taught the first ever Harry Potter class? You know, she was the first person ever to teach Harry Potter at the college level.
No.
Yep.
First
person on the planet. She's really good. For people who don't know Amy Sturgis or haven't taken her classes, I just can't recommend that enough. She's been a regular professor with us, ever since she did the Harry Potter class the first time. She has so much energy. She does such an amazing job of really bringing things together, of really sort of unfolding for people, the history of genres, you know, to see all the stuff that underlies all of the literary traditions that underlie the Harry Potter works. You know, she does a really great job with that. That class should be really cool. And our third class is a brand new class with a new instructor who's never taught at Mythgard before. Another really top Tolkien scholar who is joining us this coming semester, and that is Robin Reed. And she is teaching a class on The Lord of the Rings, and it's a different class than anything that we've offered. What Robin does as a Tolkien scholar, she is a 20th century person. She is the comparatively rare species that is a Tolkien scholar who isn't a medievalist. Her approach to The Lord of the Rings and to Tolkien is from a thoroughly 20th century point of view. So what she's going to be doing in her Lord of the Rings class is she's going to be contextualizing The Lord of the Rings within the culture of the 20th century, not within the culture of the Anglo-Saxon period, but within its immediate culture in the 20th century. And also looking at the legacy of The Lord of the Rings and the impact that it had. You know, a lot of people say things like, oh, yeah, you know, Tolkien was basically the father of the modern fantasy genre. The Lord of the Rings has had such a profound impact on people throughout the world. Well, she's going to actually be looking at that, looking at, you know, some examples of the responses that people have had, not just in the English-speaking world, but outside it. She's going to be looking at, you know, the translations of The Lord of the Rings into various different languages, and the way in which people in other non-English-speaking cultures, how they responded to The Lord of the Rings and what they picked up on and really emphasized in The Lord of the Rings, you know, in their discussions of it and in their translations of it. And so to look at the kind of impact that The Lord of the Rings has had, not just in the English-speaking world, but around the world. So that's, you know, so the course, as I said, it's a very different kind of classes. It's really going to be looking at Tolkien from a different angle than we ever have at Mythgard.
I'm really excited about that. I guess I've now discovered that I'm a modern Tolkienist, which explains why when I go do papers at these Tolkien things, people kind of looked at me strangely, because I keep bringing things into the 20th century. And I suddenly realized when you said about Robin, it's like, well, that's why. They were like, why is she doing that?
Yeah, it is funny. It's like a little countercultural, you know. And honestly, to me, that's been one of the things, you know, when I look at sort of the trend of Tolkien scholarship and the increasing acceptance of Tolkien in the scholarly world, to me, my indicator for that is the number of 20th century scholars who are willing to take it seriously. I mean, before, you know, it was just a subset of the medievalists who were taking Tolkien seriously. There were very few just straight up 20th century lit people who are interested in looking at Tolkien at all. There has been an increase in that. And more people even wanting to look at, you know, modernists in particular, have been some of the harshest critics of Tolkien from the very beginning. But even more people who study that period, you know, who are looking at, you know, first half of the 20th century literature, are now beginning to see, actually, yeah, you know, there is really a lot of stuff to talk about. That, in fact, you can see that, different as they are, you know, in so many ways, you can look at, you know, the work of the modernists, people like Joyce and Pound and Eliot, and see that they actually do share some interests in common with Tolkien, even though the expression is so different, and the spirit is so different, and the whole approach. But yet they are interested in some of the same things. So there's definitely a lot more work to be done there. But yeah, she, you know, Robin is not only a 20th century person, but she is very much a pop culture critic. You know, this is the main thing that she's very interested in.
In the conversation she and I had, she was talking about, you know, the other thing, which I know we've touched on. I mean, Tolkien is like the root of Dungeons and Dragons, which is where all the role playing stuff came from. It came from Tolkien. Dungeons and Dragons did. So, you know, I mean, she's very much up on that too. It's like the gaming. I mean, she's amazing. I'm really looking forward to this class.
Yeah,
I hope Brandon Young's taking this class. He can finally write that Tolkien Joyce paper.
Yeah, maybe he can. He's been itching to do that for a long time. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But you're right, Trish. It's exactly the kind of thing. Again, you know, some literary scholars are sort of, you know, above considering that kind, you know, gaming and stuff like that. But that's exactly the kind of thing that Robin's interested in looking at the actual, you know, cultural impact of this, you know, the way in which it has affected people. And, you know, so she looks at things like gaming, like conventions, you know, like role-playing and all that kind of thing, and the way in which Tolkien is, you know, and the kind of cultural narratives that Tolkien has influenced, and which have kind of spun off from The Lord of the Rings. So anyway, that should be a really fun class. So those are our three classes: the Lord of the Rings class with Professor Reed, the Harry Potter class with Professor Sturgis, and the Canterbury Tales with me. So those are our three classes for next time.
I should actually put a plug in that Corey's Chaucer class is bound to be really fun and interesting too.
Yeah, it's been. I've been really enjoying too. I haven't taught Chaucer in several years, and Chaucer is pretty much my second favorite author. I mean, I just love Chaucer's work, and the Canterbury Tales is just so much fun.
He uses the word adorable a lot in his Chaucer lectures.
Oh my goodness, Chaucer is so cute. Chaucer's narrators are so adorable. They are just so cute. I could hug them. I mean, oh my goodness, it is just. There's just nothing like it. There is nothing like it. I don't know any other author who is more delightful to read than Chaucer. You know, Chaucer can be scathingly critical, but he's almost never bitter. He, like, has fun all the time. You know, like, even when he's talking about serious things, there is always a hint of play. You know, it's not just that Chaucer is so much fun to read, but that I feel like Chaucer had more fun writing than, I mean, it seems like Chaucer had more fun writing than any other writer that I know.
He sort of did a lot of parodies, didn't he? Kind of, I don't know if parody is the right word, of sort of the various styles of literature of his day, right?
Sort of, yeah. As you say, it's not exactly parody, but it is. He's critical of them, but he's critical of them in kind of
an affectionate way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he will sort of kind of do send-ups of them. And in the Canterbury Tales, of course, his mockery is a little bit more direct because he will sort of embody particular inclinations or particular traditions or things in some of his pilgrims, which he can then, you know, sort of parody through their own words, right?
Right.
But so he does get a little bit more direct with the parody in the Canterbury Tales than he does in his earlier works, but yeah, I mean, he can be really thoughtful and really moving, but yet always fun, and in this really charmingly sort of self-deprecating way. Yeah, Andrew is talking about the tale of Sir Topas. You know, yeah, when Chaucer's narrator himself gets to give a story, and he starts reciting a poem, which they have to cut off in the middle because it's so bad. You know, and you get that wonderful line from Harry Bailey, the innkeeper, who's sort of the judge of the tales, you know, who says that his drasty rhyming is not worth a turd. You know, your terrible rhyming isn't worth a turd, he says. You know, he said, please stop, for God's sake. And again, that's Chaucer, you know, that he would put in the mouth of his own narrator's character the worst poetry that he wrote, you know, because it's hilarious. Anyway. There's just such great stuff there. I am very excited. So anyway, we will be doing. We're not going to be reading every tale in the Canterbury Tales because, of course, anyone who's taken classes with me knows that I really love to dig into the text and take some time. I couldn't possibly just do a survey from like 20,000 feet over the Canterbury Tales if I tried. You know, so I need to give myself time to really dig into each of the tales and look at them carefully, which means I have to be selective. So we're still reading a goodly number. So it will be a lot of fun. Anyway, okay.
Mythgard Academy class coming up.
Mythgard Academy class. Yes, we do have our class on Ender's Game, which will be beginning in about 2 weeks. I should be posting the schedule soon. I've been saying that for a while now, but it really will happen soon. I promise. That's totally near the top of my list now. And we should have that worked out. We are going to, by the way, we are going to do a session on the film adaptation at the end. So we will be talking about the recent Harrison Ford film version of Ender's Game at the end, to be doing some discussion of the adaptation. So we will definitely be doing that. Anyway, yes, I am looking forward to talking about Ender's Game.
All right.
Excellent.
Lots of exciting stuff.
Yes, lots of exciting stuff. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and Godspeed.